Today's episode is being sponsored by Hotel and Gastro Union, the largest professional association in the Swiss hospitality sector. Representing over 20,000 members, the Hotel and Gastro Union is dedicated to promoting fair working conditions and improving the social, educational, and professional prospects of everyone working in the Swiss hospitality industry. Contact Hotel and Gastro Union at www.hotelgastrounion.ch to learn more about their mission and how they can support you. Join them on their journey by following them on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram at Hotel Gastro Union, and discover how they are shaping the future of Swiss hospitality.
Good morning and welcome to 50 Shades of Hospitality. This is Crystal Cavan, your host. Today we're welcoming Walter Elnagar to our program. Welcome, Walter. It's a pleasure to have you on our podcast today. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Hey, ciao, Crystal. Thank you for having me. Well, my name is Walter Elnagar. I'm Italian, even though my name and my last name are not Italian at all. My father is originally from Alexandria in Egypt, and my mother was from Caserta. I'm from Milano, hence my Walter name, or Walter. I'm 43 next month. I'm a chef. And I live in Geneva, and it's already 7 years that I'm here.
When my co-producer, Gidio, told me that he had recently eaten at your restaurant in Geneva, I was thrilled. In fact, I'd already read several articles about you in the Swiss press, and I told him that you would be a wonderful guest to interview for our podcast. Can you tell our listeners about your restaurant and what makes it so unique?
Okay, so two February ago, I opened a restaurant called Refettorio, Geneva. Someone, I'm pretty sure, already knows the Refettorio concept from Massimo Bottura, which he opened in Milano the first time in 2015 in the occasion of the World Food Expo to save all the food waste that the expo was producing. Recover this food waste and feed the homeless of Milano. What we did, inspired by Bottura, is that in 2018, I opened a small chef counter with 12 seats, which went a bit further into this direction, meaning that we used to open 4 days for paying guests and 1 day for the homeless, serving the same avant-gardist cuisine, but free of charge. Then I came to the conclusion that 12 seats is not very much, especially if you want to have an impact. And so in 2020, I decided to go big, if you want. And I closed the restaurant and I created a foundation. And with this foundation, after the peril of COVID, we managed in 2022 to open this refettorio in collaboration with Bottura. It's a very unique refettorio because, in fact, it's not a soup kitchen, but it's a restaurant. And that's why Egidio had the chance to come for lunch, because, in fact, we open for lunch for paying guests 5 days a week. And then every day at dinner, we open for free for people in need, which is a vast array of people. It's not only homeless. And that makes Refettorio Geneva a unique establishment in the world. As far as my knowledge, there is not many restaurants like mine.
You have been referred to in the press as an idealistic rebel. Can you explain why and if you agree with this description?
But, you know, description comes from someone else. I didn't choose it, but I guess it reflects a bit my personality, my style, if you want. Am I a rebel? Well, I guess someone can label me like that. In fact, I tend to do things my own way, and I got stuck in gastronomy. I came to the conclusion that, in fact, gastronomy, it's a good environment, it's a good universe to experiment and to find your own way to express it. So I'm definitely a rebel. I'm politically a rebel, but I find my own space in my professional sphere to also be a rebel.
You were born in Italy, as you mentioned, but you left your country when you were quite young. Where did you go and why did you decide to pursue your career away from Italy?
I wasn't very young, but yes, I'll take it as a compliment. Listen, I was in Milano until 2008. 2008, which already went to the history book as a catastrophic year for many reasons, especially economical. But in Italy, it was like one step ahead of everyone else, because in fact, it was the third Berlusconi government inauguration year, unfortunately. And so, in fact, after the third election, they went in the wrong direction. I decided to quit the country because, in fact, I didn't have any more hope. And in fact, it didn't went very well. Now it's a lot of time passed. And then, so I decided to go. First, I decided to go in a cute place, which was Norway, 500 kilometers from the North Pole. It was quite nice. It's exactly what you think about Norway. It's very rich and it's very beautiful. Everyone is very blonde and very tall. But it doesn't really go with my being Mediterranean DNA. And then I got the job, the weirdest job offer from Beverly Hills in California, which I gladly took because, you know, Trondheim in Norway and Beverly Hills on the other plate. Obviously, it was an easy choice. So I went there. It was a very big surprise because I was not a very big fan of the United States and I'm still not a big fan of the United States. But out of curiosity, I went. I spent 3 months there. Then I did a networking visa, as many other million of people that go to the United States. And then I went to Mexico in a very beautiful place called San Miguel de Allende in the Guanajuato state. It's just fantastic, which I didn't know anything about. And I like went on the moon when I discovered it. I spent a year plus there. I felt in love with a girl. But then this girl dumped me in Mexico to go to Dallas in Texas, which Texas is the epitome of what everything I don't like about the United States. But then I was in love, and so I made a trip from San Miguel de Allende to Nuevo Laredo by car, which was fantastic. I still remember it. Then I spent a couple of months in Texas, but as you can imagine, I ran out of any kind of creative drive. And so I moved back to Los Angeles with her. Then I got married and I spent 7 years in Venice Beach, which became my second home after Milano. Now it's my third, because now my second home is Geneva. Then after that, I traveled around the United States a bit. I went to Maine and I went to other places. Imagine, I went to Maine in a place called Belfast, which is a lobster production place, to run a vegetarian restaurant. It was a very awkward... So I'm not new to awkward restaurants. And then after that, unfortunately, we divorced with this Alicia. And then the night that Trump got elected, just to keep alive the tradition, I left the United States for good and I went back to Mexico. So I was one of the few one that the day before said like, oh, if Trump wins, I'm going to go to Mexico. In fact, me, I did it. And it was quite a funny story. And then from there, because I divorced and I didn't have any more private life anchor to the United States, I just decided to leave. And then I went to Moscow in Russia.
Wow.
For 6 months. And then from there, I ended up in Singapore. Singapore, I stayed maybe another 6 months. Then I ended up in Dubai, which was really the weirdest place I ever been. But again, out of curiosity, you know, any place, even hell, is good to visit. It doesn't matter if you can come back. And then someone offered me a job, a dear friend of mine, Alessio Corda, offered me a job here in Geneva. And then I accepted because I am a very idealistic person. And so Geneva is the city of everything I consider beautiful in life. And it's the city of diplomacy, peace, science, negotiation, pourparler. And so I, you know, and then I was in Dubai. So any place is better than Dubai. But Geneva was very nice. In fact, I got seduced by the idea and I came here. And now it's already 7 years that I'm here. Almost 7 years. It will be in August. And then I turned out to be like a good bet. Because in fact, for my idealistic way of thinking, Geneva came out to be the perfect place to unleash a humanitarian restaurant. I don't think I would have done it anywhere else. Because you don't have the same mix of people that you have in Geneva. Maybe you have it in Bruxelles. Definitely you have it in New York. But New York is a very vast monster. Geneva has the same characteristic, but in a very small scale. So in fact, you can talk. Basically, you can meet everyone in 1 year. You meet whoever you need.
Milter, can we go back to your time in Los Angeles? I was born in Los Angeles.
Ah, fantastic.
Can you elaborate a little on your time there? I mean, what were your first impressions of living in also an incredibly multicultural city? What was it like working in the restaurant business in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, and then after in Venice?
Yeah, so listen, first I worked in Beverly Hills for the Drago family, which someone that is listening knows Los Angeles will know Celestino Giacomino and Tanino Drago. Very, very, very traditional Italian restaurant empire in Los Angeles. But when I arrived, I had no idea about what was going on in LA or what was going on in the United States, if not the political propaganda we get in Italy and stupidity you see in television. So the first thing that in fact got me, it was that I went to the first restaurant ever I worked in the United States, which was the Piccolo Paradiso on Pico and Beverly. And what really struck me was that the dishwasher was the oldest person in the kitchen. Like, literally, the guy was like, I don't know, 65-year-old, which for me, coming from Italy, I was like a very, very big surprise. And in fact, as a matter of fact, I refused to work in a place where the person that is doing the heaviest job is the oldest. So there I got my, now is my nickname, Med Chef, because in fact, everyone in the kitchen was like, okay, but in fact, bro, that's what it is here. There is no chance you're going to change this overnight. You better suck it up. Like, it's the way it is. And then I was very skeptical because I was like, okay, so this place. So I got a chance to visit more restaurants, as you can imagine. And then I have to say, like, back in 2008, cross nine, gastronomy was quite good in the United States because it is good. When it's good, as you know. They don't lack money. Budget is not a concern. Workforce is not a concern. But it wasn't really the what I was looking for. Back then, I used to have this Italian mindset in which only Italian gastronomy is gastronomy. Only my grandmother meatballs are the best. Now I lost it because, in fact, it's bullshit. Then I stepped into the multicultural Los Angeles ecosystem, which is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's beyond imagination. And then I started, you know, I had the privilege to work with Japanese chefs, Filipino chefs, Mexican chefs, Salvadorian chef, Korean chef, you name it, whatever. And also subculture into the Japanese, subculture into the Korean. Like, you know, it's such a vast thing. So in fact, it's my appreciation for the Californian gastronomy grew, especially if you consider the farmer markets, product-driven ethos that there is. But then at the same time, it radicalized into being very against Californian gastronomy because in fact, it's based into a racial segregation of Mexican, which is very evident that you cannot avoid. In fact, my first impression about the old guy in the kitchen, it was correct. But it goes way more deeper than having an old person. In fact, the old person must be a Native American from Central America. And then, in fact, if you look around you, everyone is like that. And then the epitome of this was a restaurant that a friend of mine opened in Rose Avenue in Venice Beach. Super fancy. The place is fantastic. So the first thing that doesn't work is Venice Beach. Half of the population is homeless. For me, it's already weird to have like fancy restaurant and half of the population homeless. It's like, okay, let's assume everyone is heavily on Xanax and no one understands that they are homeless. Okay, great. Then you enter this restaurant. I think it was a day that changed my life because I entered the restaurant. It's an open kitchen. It's a very long counter and there is a staff meeting. So the staff meeting is front of house. Everyone is completely white or shade of white, like more white or less more white. Everyone is very beautiful and da, 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 da. And then behind the counter, it's not even close by a wall. Behind the counter, everyone 100% is from Oaxaca or from Morelos. But it was so evident. Like, it was such a thing that I was like, wow, this is so wrong. Like, you know, there is a movie, I'm pretty sure you saw it too, from California. It's like A Day Without Mexicans.
One of my favorite movies.
It was one of those kind of things. It was like, okay, you know, this mega beautiful restaurant, if you remove the people that is chained in the kitchen, wow, what's going to happen? And then I started the reflection. And then, in fact, you know, Californian farmer market driven cuisine, where remove the people that is in the field. This is my more or less my point of view about what's going on there. It's fantastic. You can eat food that you don't get anywhere else. Los Angeles itself has this Korean, especially the Asian, Korean, Chinese in the valley, Japanese in Sotel. I mean, you get food that is unbelievably fantastic. Let's not talk about Mexican. Mexican, you get some stuff, it's like, wow. But you need to take the package, complete package. You also need to understand what you're doing, what you're contributing to, and in which kind of ecosystem you're working. Otherwise, it will not be coherent. So that's my view at large.
So, Walter, I want to go back to something you had mentioned about, you know, thinking that Italian food was the best food in the world, which, by the way, you know, I have to agree a little bit with that. It is amazing. How much did your Italian upbringing influence, or how much does it continue to influence your cuisine? I mean, how would you describe your style of cuisine, what you're making?
Obviously, your formative years. This is a common thing that you share with every member of humanity. Your formative years are your formative years. You cannot remove it. I was lucky enough to grow up in an Italian family first. Second of all, I was lucky / unlucky, depends on the point of view, to grow up in a family of peasants from South Italy on a mountain, very self-sufficient kind of village. Even though I'm from 81, I still remember my grandmother going to the well, water well, to grab the water because she didn't trust the water from the faucet. You know, that kind of family. Growing your own crops, feeding your own animals from rabbits to chickens to whatever it is the case. So self-sufficiency and solidarity is what my family inject in my brain, if
barbecue.
This is my own take on Italian cuisine. Italian cuisine is like very similar to Japanese cuisine. There's few ingredients. The ingredient must be top. Pico de season, if it's like vegetable, so it has to be a pristine protein if it comes from the sea. And then there is minimal manipulation, which that's what you really do also in Japanese cuisine, if you know. Almost all the Japanese cuisine. So this I saved because I think is a quite interesting aspect. And today, my cuisine today, it's more or less reflects the same thing. Plus, now I have a 20-year experience into this field. So I added all the layers of mostly techniques that I learn around the world. And then I'm a very avid reader. I read a lot of books. I like to incorporate, I try to incorporate as much as possible techniques from other chefs. Then again, I am one of the last of the millennials. So we were very lucky, my generation, to get the birth of internet. And so we feed also on the shared knowledge that there is on the internet, especially from the contemporary cuisine repertoire. You know, there is this chef in Spain, Ferran Adrià, he calls it the share creativity. It's a common creativity that takes to the internet. In fact, we can share and it feeds itself. So if before there was like this kind of the idea of the chef with the secret notebook, or you have to go to the restaurant for the secret sauce. Now it's the stupidest thing ever. It's like, first of all, why would you have any secret? You know, now it's no longer like that. Now creativity feeds itself with more creativity. I like to think, and I wish that is true, that I am part of this like common brain of chefs around the world. I hope it was clear, but if you want it more clear, in fact, my cuisine is like creative, technical, and seasonal, and market-driven.
Were you influenced at all by Egyptian cuisine, in the cuisine of North Africa or the Levant or...
Not yet. Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. My father has been in Milano for 50 years.
Ah, okay.
So, in fact, he didn't came for... Now it sounds very weird, especially for kids. In fact, my father is not an immigrant like the immigrant of today. Like, he didn't came with a boat. It's like a migrant, more or less, like me. I am a migrant myself. Even Egidio is a migrant. Maybe even you.
Even I'm a migrant.
Oh, of course. I'm not an expat. I like to underline that because I think expat is bullshit. So when my father came to Milan, it was like the end of the 70s. He's like from a generation that didn't have any will or any interest in passing his roots to the offsprings. So in fact, unfortunately, I don't speak Arabic. This is unfortunately, I like to underline this because I wish I did. And so I didn't have many exchange with the other part of my family to this day. Because in fact, what I learned by traveling around the world, the few travel I did, really need to deep yourself into the culture. Having a last name, it doesn't really, it doesn't allow me to do anything. So far, I did not had any influence from the Arabic or like North African cuisine. I wish one day it's going to be the case.
You know, you were mentioning all of these incredible places that you've worked and you know about these different places, Norway. We've talked about Los Angeles, Mexico, Russia, Singapore. Have these different places influenced and have they had an impact on your culinary art?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yes. In fact, I reconnect with the story of any provincial chef in Italy thinks that Italian cuisine is there. Outside Italy, it's everything is a desert. I remember like maybe the very first time it wasn't the first. The first one, it was in Norway. So I went to Norway. I went to work with this Italian, again, three brothers, just like Los Angeles. I don't know why. Followed me at my beginning. And they were using like, you know, this mozzarella that comes from Caserta. But everyone knows the mozzarella comes from Caserta. Well, in Norway, you can sell it to the Norwegian, but you cannot sell it to me. It doesn't work. So I start to inquire about like, but in Norway, there must be some cheese, no? Why we don't go get some cheese from Norway? Then I start to inquire with local produce. I have to say that in Norway is more difficult because everything is frozen up, so there is not much product. Then I went to Los Angeles. Los Angeles at the beginning was difficult because it's such a mammoth city that you don't get right away into the farmer market, sorry. But then I went to Mexico. When I went to Mexico, San Miguel de Allende is a village, beautiful village, but it really is a village. And then I end up in a restaurant, and again, we're using like mozzarella from Caserta. Now, okay, San Miguel de Allende, I don't know, look it up because one fantastic place. It's 8 hours from any coast, and it's 5 hours from the closest airport. and then it's central Mexico. Now, with all the love I have for Mexico, the supply chain is not the best. So there is really, there should be no discussion about not using import cheese from Italy. So I went to around the city to look for a market, and God bless, when I found the market, it was like epiphany. It's like a Nirvana moment. In fact, I did that everywhere I went, to the point that when I ended up in Dubai, in fact, I was like, okay, but there must be farms in Dubai. So first reaction of everyone, the owner of the restaurant, the manager, is like, oh, but this is nonsense. Why? Just use this pomodoro pacchino from Sicily. And I'm like, no, I don't care. It's like, whatever, let's find the market. Last thing you will suspect, in fact, in Dubai, there are farms scattered all around. There is fish farms. And I went to visit the whole thing. Fantastic. There is a farmer market. And it's quite interesting because if you think about a city like Dubai, in fact, it's a city with zero culture. Oh, zero roots. Like, you know, 50 years back, no one was growing any vegetables because it was not part of the thing. It's like the Inuit in Siberia. If all of a sudden they get developed, they will develop some kind of agriculture. And this agriculture comes from the immigrants that are settling there. So in fact, you get incredibly good product in Dubai, fresh, homegrown, because you take the chance to go to the Pakistani restaurant and ask at the Pakistani restaurant, hey, where did you got your ingredients? And the first reaction is always surprised because it's like, why this guy European? Why? But then you discover stuff that is quite fantastic. And that I did it everywhere, and I'm quite proud of it. In Russia, I did the same. It was funnier in another way because everyone was, not everyone, but like the owners of the restaurant, the very bourgeois, they like, no, we must use European products. But this is a cultural thing. And so they brought me to a black market spot for European product because EU just unleashed the embargo on foodstuff back then. Now imagine my face at the black market in Moscow, again, Parmigiano. It's like, this is not even Parmigiano, man. It's selling it to you as Parmigiano, but this is like a kilometer away from the real product. So there I went to look for normal market. Well, you will be astonished how many farmer markets there are in Moscow. Fantastic stuff. Each place has its own point of view about this. And sometimes it's like, you know, Russia food really is like a status symbol. So in fact, it's better to eat like low-grade Parmigiano, even if there is a food embargo, you know, like makes your status symbol go high. And a place like in California, it's much better to eat Parmesan, but Californian. You know, like it depends. The reception from the guest, it really is a cultural thing. Me, myself, I don't really care about the reception from the guest. I found pleasure by feeding my knowledge of local ingredients and the culture that is attached to it. And the people you meet at these markets, the people you meet in these farms, you know, like it enrich you for real. If you really want to know a culture, for sure you need to go to a library. For sure you need to go to see a worshiping place. But if you really want to know a culture, you go where people eat. This is my take. Maybe it's not true, but this is my take.
I agree. Let's come back to Switzerland. You mentioned why you decided you wanted to work in Geneva because of its humanitarian and scientific and its reputation for dialogue and diplomacy. Before coming here, did you know this city? Had you visited before?
No. I knew Geneva only from the school books. Uh-huh. Geneva, you know, Geneva Convention and the Red Cross, the CERN, and
the United Nations. Yeah.
Yeah. In Italy, it's very. You know, half of the people that works at the UN in Geneva are Italian.
Ah, okay.
And at the Red Cross, and there is a reason. It's like we have been fed by this idea of Geneva.
And when you arrived in Geneva, what were your first impressions? What did you think about Switzerland and Geneva? And
the job I accepted, it was the wrong job, because in fact, I ended up in a 5-star hotel. It was just like Dubai all over again. In fact, I opened this restaurant called the Fiske Bar, fantastic restaurant. But in fact, I was a servant, again, for people that doesn't really care about the farmer market. In fact, they don't even care about the food. They're just there because of the status symbol of being there. I can afford to go to the Ritz-Carlton. In fact, I can afford to order a full tasting menu and not hit anything on it, just because I can. You know, and for me, it's like it's not a thing. And so I went into a crisis. Because I was like, wow, I'm in Geneva and I'm working again in exactly the same place. And so there, in fact, I decided to change the whole scenario.
And your restaurant, Le Refettario, is located in a working class neighborhood in Geneva.
It is.
It's described as a gourmet canteen. Was this a conscious decision? And if so, can you explain your reasons and give us a little bit, maybe more information about how this restaurant, Le Refettario, is different from other restaurants. You've already spoken a little bit about that, but can you tell us a little bit more?
The main idea, in fact, it connects to this Ritz-Carlton story. In fact, what I discovered is, like, in fact, I'm not free to choose to who am I cooking for. Why? Because there is this kind of a prejudice. In fact, it's like, you know, if you want to do a creative cuisine and market-driven and organic, contemporary, avant-gardist, ultra-local, hyper-technical, there are very few people that can appreciate that, and they all from the elite. But in fact, this is not a plus. First of all, it's not true, because in fact, taste, it's a human characteristic that is shared by everyone. Then there is bad taste and good taste. Your socio-economical background, it should not imply for your life you're doomed as far as gastronomy. But then I flipped the story, and in fact, the story was cooks, they don't have the freedom to choose to whoever they like to. Especially they're not allowed to cook for the people that actually need food. So that was the first push. It was like a struggle for freedom. Through my professional thing, I'm just a cook. And then there is the story of the food waste and loss, because the right name is food waste and loss, which is in fact is a systemic catastrophe. It's not like a mystical thing that is happening and you cannot do anything. In fact, it's a systemic thing that it's pushed by the system itself. And again, you can choose not to follow this kind of road that is in front of you. You can just choose to open another one. And then with Bottura, that opened the dance, if you want, in 2015, you know, I decided to put together like a restaurant where, in fact, we welcome everyone as an inclusive restaurant on the principle that, in fact, taste is personal. It's not economical. So the people that comes at night to eat for free, sometimes they don't like the food because it doesn't mean that because you're hungry, so you must like the food. You know, this is like another prejudice. Just like the people at lunch, sometimes people don't like the food because food is what it is, you know, it's your taste. Maybe it's due to cultural thing, maybe it's due to habits. And then the other thing, it's not the hardest job in the universe, cooking, but it's a very intense thing. We work hard, we work like sometimes you work 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day to make food. And in fact, the system tells you that anything that is not sold and made a profit can go to the trash. Okay, now for how long are you going to do that consciously? When you get the conscious about what's going on. In fact, what you're tossing in the trash is not a beautiful piece of langoustine croustillant or langoustine crisp. What you're doing is you're tossing into the trash your work that is crystallized into this preparation. You're tossing the work of the chain supply, the producer, the farmer, the fishmonger, and everyone into the chain. And in an age where everyone is going crazy for climate change, we need to do this, we need to do that, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, how come you allowed all the production behind foodstuff to go to the trash? Now we are in 2024. This is common knowledge. So when you decided to do it, you're doing it consciously. And you know, for me, I came to the realization that that's what it is. And then I cannot consciously keep doing that. I'd rather quit and do something else. So I decided to put together a place where we can express this kind of value and I can offer a job position to people that really care about this kind of... It's not even about that. It's in fact, one restaurant doesn't going to change the system. There will be grandiosity complex to the maximum level. But we can give an example.
Yeah. Exactly. And logistically, Walter, how difficult is it to really do as much as you can to avoid any kind of food waste? I mean, did you have to, I mean, I can imagine that you have this idea of not wanting any food waste, but the actual logistics of saying, okay, how can we really avoid this? I can imagine it was challenging for you.
In fact, for me, it was less challenging than for other people. Not because I'm very smart, it's just because I'm very creative. And creativity, this is my own opinion of creativity. Creativity, it's born from needs. So it's the need. In fact, it's the difficulties you are in that makes you creative. So in fact, avoiding food waste is a must do in a place like mine or in our business. And so this is supposed to feed your creativity because it presents many challenges. But this, at least the way I see it as a enhancing of my creative process. Because, you know, there is a very common saying in the restaurant business, like everyone is good to sear a piece of foie gras and everyone is good to a spoon of caviar on top of whatever. This doesn't really sound very creative. Even if you put the caviar on top of a strawberry, someone already did it. It's not very creative. It takes nothing because you have no saying into this caviar production. But to take something that is considered trash and transform it using techniques that are super interesting and super nice into something delicious, that is the epitome of creativity.
Walter, can you tell us more about your foundation, Fondazione Mater?
So Mater Foundation, it's the platform that I created in 2020 to operate the restaurant. And in fact, I'm not the only chef to have a foundation, I discovered. In fact, a foundation is a very gray thing. No one knows exactly what it is. What is a foundation? Is it a company or is it a charity? It's an organization. And the main characteristic of this type of organization is that it's a non-profit. So now me, I cannot create a socialistic company in Switzerland or anywhere. Maybe in China, I don't know, maybe in Cuba, but not here. So the closest thing to a socialistic non-profit thing, in fact, is a non-profit. And the best form of a non-profit, at least in Switzerland, it's a foundation, because it's one notch up than an association. An association, you know, you can do it in a bar with five people and you have the association about food waste. A foundation, there is more work behind and it's more heavy as a structure. When you found a foundation, you never know what's going to happen with this foundation. Maybe in 50 years, it's still going to be here. Maybe not. I don't know. So we use this platform. First, it was intended only to run the restaurant. And then we saw that, in fact, we can do many more things. And one thing that we do is advocacy. Because, in fact, if we want to use the restaurant to give example, if we don't propagate this message, it would be impossible to give example to anyone. So we do advocacy. That it targets mostly human rights and specifically the right to food. And then we do other food assistance programs in which basically we started to help other organizations and other platforms to improve their own operation or to do something else that they may require from us, because we are very outsider into this field. But one thing that we do not do is charity. So in fact, my foundation, Fondazione Mater, is not a charity organization, but it's a worker working organization that promotes social inclusion through gastronomy. That's what it is. Then it's a very small organization. Sounds great, but it's a baby organization still.
Oh, but I don't think it's the size that counts, is it?
We'll see. Time will tell.
This podcast series is intended to be a training tool, a vehicle of information that complements the academic curriculum of hospitality institutions around the world. Through this platform, what would you say to young people who may be interested in embracing a career in culinary arts and, you know, based on your experience of what you've seen and done in your life, what kind of message would you have for young people who are perhaps considering this career path?
Well, it's a very long thing, but I guess inspired by what we discussed right now, I would say to young people that are interested into gastronomy to stand against exploitation. Exploitation of cooks, exploitation of the lands, exploitation of the natural resources, exploitation of culture. And by doing that and deeply looking at gastronomy with this lens, you may be able in 10, 20, 30 years to work into restaurants that are truly unique, truly creative, because they're based on collaboration and not exploitation. One very concrete example is last year we did a certification on food waste. And in fact, the main result of this is that we lower CO2 emissions. This is great. We were not thinking about this whatsoever. And me, I'm of the thought family that if you want to solve climate change, you stop wars first, because it's the biggest emission. But then we did the food waste certification, and in fact, we can quantify that we lower 2 tons of CO2. Now, 2 tons of CO2 is like 2 cars. Sure, it's not much. Of course, it's not much. But at least in a society that is like imposing you to do something, when the best thing that they suggest to do is compost and don't take a shower, well, you know what? This is much better, because through my profession, I can make a choice to, in fact, have that kind of impact. And that it's, again, you choose not to exploit the natural resources. That's what I will suggest to young kids. I know kids will not like this kind of thing, because they're thinking about making a beautiful dish and the plating and the beautiful knives and the beautiful uniforms. But you will discover that it's not about that. And when you reach that point, think about freedom. Your own freedom first. I hope it was not too idealistic, but...
No, not for me. It's never too idealistic. Walter, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and for sharing your vision and your idealistic ideas about where we should be going, the direction we should all be going. We really want to thank you again for being part of our podcast adventure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Ciao. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's episode is being sponsored by Hotel and Gastro Union, the largest professional association in the Swiss hospitality sector. Representing over 20,000 members, the Hotel and Gastro Union is dedicated to promoting fair working conditions and improving the social, educational, and professional prospects of everyone working in the Swiss hospitality industry. Contact Hotel and Gastro Union at www.hotelgastrounion.ch to learn more about their mission and how they can support you. Join them on their journey by following them on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram at Hotel Gastro Union, and discover how they are shaping the future of Swiss hospitality.